Now it's time for This Day in History. On July 18th, on this Thursday, we will remember many things. This is really interesting. This is a day in 1863 that the 54th Massachusetts Color Regiment launched its assault on Fort Wagner, South Carolina, made famous by the movie Glory. But you know some things they didn't tell you in that movie that we should remember? That some of those characters, like the character played by Denzel Washington, never dropped the flag. He picked up the flag and fought until the bitter end. And he went on to win the Congressional Medal of Honor, become one of the greatest soldiers in history there. And the character, played by Morgan Freeman, Sergeant Major Rawlings, didn't die. He kept going. But the real Sergeant Major, you know who that was? Frederick Douglass's son. These are little pieces of history. If you put them in movies and tell us our real history, you can keep the drama, but give reality to our lives and inspire citizens with the truth. This is a day that Nelson Mandela was born in 1918. Happy birthday, Nelson Mandela, who taught us what a revolution can do. This is also the day that Adolf Hitler published his first volume of Mein Kampf, 1925, I should say. This is the birthday of Screamin' Jay Hawkins. In 1929, he was born, this blues singer, one of my favorites, I Put a Spell on You, you remember that one, that he put out in 1956? This is the day in 1940 that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the only president ever more than two terms elected, was elected for his third term. And in 1981, 10,000 people marched through the streets of Dublin in support of Republican hunger strikers in May's prison in Northern Ireland. It's a struggle we covered intensely in the 1990s here on the Mark Steiner Show. The march was all these protesters outside the British embassy and began fighting with the police who said they were protecting the embassy, who then charged prisoners, putting 200 people in the hospital. But it was the day that the revolts were being born in Northern Ireland for their freedom and independence, which they never got, really. In 1982, this is the day 268 peasants, campesinos, were murdered, slain in the Plain de Sanchez massacre in Guatemala. We paid for that. The United States government helped in those tortures and killings. And these things we cannot forget. It's not what we want to have our legacy be. And that was our day in history, July the 18th.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine.
We're going to spend this first hour of our program today talking about our environment here in Baltimore City. And that environment is our housing. There was an article that spurred this conversation on that we read yet last week, which had to do with replacing 80 residents here in Baltimore who lived in communities on blocks where maybe one house was left with a family in it or a person in it. People living in isolation. And the city had made some vague notion about wanting to create gardens. We don't know what that means, but we'd like to know what that means. Then we saw the money that Exelon was given to build their new headquarters downtown. Some people are arguing that money's actually going to come back to Baltimore. Others are arguing, no, it's a giveaway. We can talk about that a bit. But the real question is housing a right? Is housing an obligation for our society to ensure? And none of the people in our studio today are housing officials, but they're all housing activists on one level or another. And we want to kind of explore with you as well at 410-319-8888 what you think housing policy should be. If you could run the city, if you could run the tens of millions of dollars of housing money in this town, how would we spend it differently? What would housing look like? The Mayor's 10,000 program, is that a priority? Are there other priorities? So we're going to wrestle with some of that with all of you this hour. We are joined here by Randy Ford. He's a United Worker leader who's affected by the University of Maryland expansion in West Baltimore. Good to meet you, Randy, and have you in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me here.
Joining us by phone is Clara Bailey. Clara Bailey lives on a block that is mostly vacant and is working with the city to get her property appraised. And is one of those blocks we talked about. Clara, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good morning.
Jeff Singer's in the studio, founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless.
Good morning. Thank you.
Out there still fighting. Peter Sabonis is with us. Human Right to Work with Dignity Program and co-director for the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. Good to have you back in the studio, Peter. It's been a while.
Good to be here, Mark.
And Mel Freeman is with us, executive director of the Citizens Planning and Housing Association.
Good morning, Mark.
And number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook page. We really do want to hear your voice here this morning. Let me begin by asking both, first start this way. I think it's important for us to get some perspective given the article last week with Clara Bailey and Randy Ford. And Clara, let me start with you if I might, then we'll go to Randy. Could describe for our listeners who may not have experienced this what it is like to live on a block that is abandoned, a block where you are the lone human being living there in a home that belongs to you.
Well, right. It used to be okay because the houses at first wasn't in bad condition. But over the years, the wear and tear on these properties that no one is claiming is beginning to affect my home. And when I say that, I'm saying because the floors inside the houses are falling, the back of the houses are falling. Then you got different people, you know, squatting inside these houses and anything else. That's the problem I'm having. Then you have the vacancy houses where people are just putting themselves inside of them, or even just tearing them up, coming inside and stripping the you know, for the pipes and for the anything else that they can take out of the houses. That's the whole problem that I'm having. I've been calling the city for over 20 years now, asking them to do something with this property. The one house next to me, caught on fire, no one ever did anything with that property. The rest of the houses, no one ever did anything with that. This block used to have people living in these houses. It was never an empty house. But over the last past 20 years, 25 years, no one has lived there. And they haven't came to do anything with this property. I've sit back and waited and waited and waited and waited. It never happened. So now what do I do? I can understand how some people don't want their property to be torn down or whatever, but where I'm living at now, it's beginning to be where I opened up my closet one day, a pigeon flew out.
Oh, my God.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
I'm laying in bed one day. The squirrels from the vacant house came, made a hole, and came into my property. That means I have to pay out money to get someone to come in here and actually fix everything that they didn't tore up.
Because that you own your house.
Right.
And Randy, why don't you jump in? Your thoughts on what it's like to live in a community like that. And let me get the mic closer to you so you can be heard. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Well, I've been in a community like that where every house on the block is either boarded up or slated for demolition. And, you know, there's one person living in the block. And it disturbs me because what are you going to do with these houses? You know, and if the city is not going to do anything with those homes, then what's the purpose? I mean, what are you doing? You know, the homeowner can't do anything. Is it a process of eminent domain or something like that? That's all I want to know, because if the homeowner can't do anything but what she needs to do to her property and can't do anything else for the home, for the properties beside her, then that's the problem. If she tries to do any repairs to her home and it happens to have an effect on the crumbling homes,
right,
then there could be a problem. She could get a fine or something. So either you're in or out.
Let me get a caller. Some people are calling. Let me get at least one caller in here before we bring our other guests in at 410-319-8888. Yvonne, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yvonne, welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to make a comment on how the housing department is using money to revitalize the city. And I wanted to comment on one particular area, which is the Greenmount Avenue, Preston Street area. I see they're revitalizing the area, but particularly there's a new high-rise building there that people are going to be put in this high-rise building that have to be 50% below the poverty level. And I just see that area being a replay of what we had in the past of a high-rise project building. I would have much rather seen them revitalize the area and put in different income levels for people in the community than just to create a new project high-rise building. I think that's what that's going to end up being.
Yvonne, you raised an important issue that Stay tuned here. I'm going to raise that with everybody here in a few minutes so we can kind of wrestle with your thoughts are on that. 410-319-8888. So get me a very quick question before we turn to other guests. Clara and Randy, when you live in a place where you're the only person on a block, is there a sense of isolation, a sense of fear, or is it just you're happy or is it that living that way is fine except for the crumbling houses? Clara?
I mean, it's not fine because you're subjected to, when you're the only person that lives on a block where there's no one living there, It's like they forget that you're there. The city forgets that you're there. Because I have a problem with street lights. I have a problem with trash. I have a problem with a lot of things that the city does as far as my block. The city has a bobcat that tore up a pavement that's right there in front of my house. They never came back and put it back. They never came back and fixed it. They didn't do anything. When I step out my door at night, it's dark. The city has a garden right across the street from me. They're talking about putting more gardens. You're not taking care of the garden that's across the street from me. Inside that garden is nothing but rats. And then everybody placed their trash there. And you're talking about another garden? I don't think we need another garden. Not at all, because I'm having problems with the one I have across the street. And there used to be vegetables and everything else growing in that garden. But what has the city done with that? I have to call every 6 months just to remind them to come and cut the grass. Because of the rats. Because of the trash. Because of illegal dumping. So the city's talking about putting another garden. Garden isn't going to work. It's not going to work. The lady just said about Greenmount and Preston.
Right.
That's the area I live in. Down the street from me, they just put a brand new apartment building down there. That's part of Johnson Square. I live in the Oliver community. The city always says how much money they give to the Oliver community. But it never comes to Huffman Street. Because why? Because I'm only one person on a block. It's not a whole house, a whole block full of people. Because if it was more people in that block, they would pay more attention to you. They never come down to this end of the block to actually find out what do we need in the block. And I went to plenty of community meetings. Believe me, I volunteer every day. I volunteer today at the food bank, right after I talk to you, for Oliver. But what are you doing for my community? What are you doing for my block? I've sat there and called time and time again. I even wrote the mayor a letter, also called Stokes and everyone else a letter, as far as my lighting, where I live at, the street, the trash. The city takes every bit of trash and put right next to my house when they picks it up. Why is that? Like I said, I haven't just started. This has been going on for years that I have to deal with that.
So, and Randy, what are you going to say? Then we'll jump into our other guests here as well.
Well, these are the questions. Excuse me. These are the questions that we ask at the United Workers, the organization I'm with right now that I volunteer with. Besides you wanting to build, gardens, okay? What is that going to do? Even if. If you do build a garden, so far and few times in between that someone comes out and tends these gardens, okay? So basically I used to live in that neighborhood myself, and I've seen the changes that's gone on over there. And I've seen that building coming up. I saw a development coming in a long time ago.
So let me bring other guests in here. I mean, I'm curious your response to what you've heard. I mean, all of you, some level or another, in this room have been legal or physical organizers in communities and working in issues of housing a lot. So we have a huge email conversation going on the Mark Steiner page, which I'm going to read some of. People have been writing in because of the show. They're really exercised about this issue. So what's your response to what our other two guests have said and what you think we need to be looking at rather than what we're doing, if it is a rather? Who wants to go first? Mel, go ahead. Mel Freeman from the Citizens Planning and Housing Association.
Good morning, Mark. Yeah, this is so complicated and so personal that, it's hard to talk about this without really saying, I'm talking about you as a person and we don't think you should live somewhere. That's what makes this conversation so complicated. There are folks that have lived in neighborhoods for 20, 30, 40 years, and now they're the last one on their block. They've really tried to hold out to see if something is going to happen, and nothing has ever happened. So at this point, we're left with a block that's both losing value personally for that person, wasting resources for the city, and all kinds of dollars are just being thrown out there and they're not going to go anywhere. So when do we say enough's enough? I care about those families that are there. I think what we left out here is, you know, I don't want to tell someone I'm going to take your house and build a garden. I think I would have handled it differently. I also would have had a plan prior to that to try and figure out, you love your neighborhood, how can we keep you close, nearby? We have resources to figure out where we can have possibly a swap of a house or something, some new plan besides, okay, you got to go. And these conversations shouldn't happen overnight. You know, you should be having conversation with folks in neighborhoods over a period of time. You know, you don't drop this kind of bomb on someone and expect them to react cogently at all.
Jeff?
It seems to be the intersection between the personal and the political. And yesterday, Memorial Day, I volunteer with a community arts program called Mosaic Makers, and we did an art intervention on Fulton Avenue. We went from North Avenue down to Edmondson Avenue, and in the median strip, we put pieces of concrete that had been mosaicked to bring something back to the community where I had worked 40 years ago. I counted the vacant houses on Fulton Avenue, which is an area that's been redeveloped to some extent. Anton Winchester, at least 500 new houses in the last 20 years, right? But on Fulton Avenue, 20% of the houses today are vacant. However, if you go one block to the east or west, 60 to 80% of the houses are vacant. I think one of the messages is that you probably can't build a good city one neighborhood at a time, and using the kinds of resources and strategies that we've been using. Our economic development strategies, which I think we'll all begin to talk about very soon here on,
yes,
on the program, have failed in Baltimore and every other American city for, well, at least in the 20th century and the 21st. And until we change the way we do economic development, our guests here and so many other people we know are going to suffer.
Peter.
I think we have to see the image of vacant housing as failed development. That's what it is, essentially. It's a housing issue, yes, but it's a bigger issue than that. It's a failure of the city's policies relative to development. And development is oftentimes separated into two different silos. You have economic development, you have community development. The economic development, the big downtown developers get resourced by TIFs, pilots, tax breaks, bonds, et cetera. The community developers, well, they get a little CDBG money, low-income housing tax credit, whatever they can scrape together to do some housing work. These are not separate issues. It's one type of development. And what we see here, is, quite frankly, as Mel pointed out, is a development policy that's never really had any participation. No public input, really. It's been a group of people who are making decisions about which neighborhoods win, which neighborhoods lose, mm-hmm. what gets developed, what gets packaged. And quite frankly, there are too many people left out. And that's simply because the people aren't involved in the process.
Now, the city would argue probably, I'm not here today, and that's because we called them last week. It was probably late in the week, and they couldn't get anybody over here, so I'm not going to condemn them for not being here today, which is all right. We'll come back, and we'll have them here for a large conversation with them in the room as well. But they would argue, I'm sure, look, we do have community meetings. We do reach out and tell people what's going on and what we're about to do. You know, we're not just doing this in a vacuum.
$107 million TIF was given to developers in the Harbor Point area in a meeting that was closed to the public. And the city seemed to be proud of that because, oh, there was proprietary information and our developers can't do their work if everyone knows what they're doing. But as Peter has pointed out, these are public issues. This is supposed to be a democracy, and yet these decisions are not made in a democratic fashion.
Mark, I'd say that you have to think out of the box when it comes to participation, because I think what has been demonstrated is that with increased income inequality, that there is a certain group that is dominant in the media, that is dominant in government, that gets heard more than other groups. And we really need to think about we need to think about community councils. We need to think about neighborhood participatory processes that go beyond just simply contacting a few community organizations, which we know are vary in terms of strength and leadership and energy in the city. So I think that is part of the government's role, is actively engaging the community. You just don't put something up on the internet when you know that lots of folks don't have access to the internet. You just don't have a few community meetings. There are ways we can get out there, engage the public. There should be discussions going on right now in the community all over about our vacant housing, about our community development, economic development strategy. It should be ours. It shouldn't be an issue of trying to figure out what's going on.
But people would argue on the other side, and Randy, I saw you nodding your head, so you and Mel can jump into this, but the people would argue, and Clara as well, that argue, well, look, but that's not economic development. That doesn't drive the economy of the city. That's not putting money into bringing people, money into the city and middle-class families in the city. That is might be feel-good community stuff, but what does that have to do with building our city? That would be one argument, I think, you might hear from some folks in city government.
Well, you could build your city by putting people back to work in the city. I mean, all the homeless people out here, they're not without skill. There are some people out there on the street that have skill, but you're going to dismiss them because they're on the street. Give them something to work for, and maybe give them the incentive that they might get that house that they're building, that they can, you know, help you rebuild your community, but give them the chance to maybe live in the house that they're rebuilding. If that can be some incentive, and if you do pay them a living wage.
I mean, if we did that, my question I have before we go to break here, if we have time for a quick question, is where would that money come from? Let's just take that one question. We're going to come into larger policy questions. I can hear Bob Embry in a conversation saying to me, yes, that dollar program was 40 years ago. It doesn't exist. We don't have that money anymore. That money doesn't exist for individuals to rebuild their homes. It's not there. Banks don't back it. Feds don't back it.
Plus, there's just far too many. I mean, the Dollar House program was in some smaller, very distinct neighborhoods. We're talking about, we said 80 people are being displaced per the Sun Ad. Right. So we're talking about probably 40 blocks or 60 blocks, which is really more like 1,500, 1,600, or 1,700 houses. And they're not in the same place. They're scattered throughout the city. Dollar House doesn't really seem to fit at this point of the game.
But we're not asking for the dollar houses. Okay, we're asking to give the people the jobs to build these houses, which you won't have to basically give them away.
We have to take a break. We'll come back, and I really want to hear what our policy alternatives are from this panel, and also read what our listeners are saying on Facebook. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Remind you on our way back to our conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a bank members of credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. www.mecu.com or go to signershow.org and click on their banner. MECU, Baltimore Credit Union's banner is always there. We are here with Clara Bailey, lives on a block that is mostly vacant, is working with the city to get her property appraised. And Randy Ford, United Worker Leader impacted by the University of Maryland expansion in West Baltimore. Jeff Singer, founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless. Peter Sabonis, Human Right to Work with Dignity Program, co-director for the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. And Mel Freeman, executive director of the Citizens Planning and Housing Association. And we're going to just jump right into then what do we do instead? What is our alternative? People have written in here on Facebook. Lee Raskin writes in, hooray for the 1,500 vacant houses to be demolished, but what about the 15,000 rats that will be uprooted? hopefully the city will, and Jenny Dill writes in, hopefully the city will have done some rat abatement during and after the demolition. Gail Grove writes in, the city will probably give the homeowners much less than what their homes appraised for, especially if the city does the appraisals. However, Timothy Poole writes in, the city doesn't do appraisals. They hire outside appraisers to do that work, and they typically take the highest of multiple proposals. Historically, most people get more from the city for their property than they would if they sold it on the open market. I'll read the others in a moment. But so what is our alternative? Whether we're talking about these vacants. Like, let me just read one piece that Mike Johnson wrote in, who's been a guest in so many times. Mike Johnson wrote in, at some point, a long vacant house becomes impossible to renovate and make habitable. You must raise it and start over. I think green space, parks, and gardens change any neighborhood for the better. I live in a 1,100-square-foot, two-bedroom, one-bath with no off-street parking, 50-year-old wooden floors, a 9x9 kitchen, and no closet space. Technically, that is a house, and it works for me. But the majority of people would pay five times the cost of my house to live 2 miles away in a detached with a garage. Houses do not always mean housing. The longer those vacants sit empty, the worse for everybody. So our thoughts. You heard what our listeners have to say. We'll go back to the phones.
Well,
what do we do? What is the plan that would make it work? Because we've been covering this for 20 years, and 40 years ago, I was a tenant organizer in South Baltimore when it was a poor working class neighborhood. We've been fighting this battle for a long time. What's the alternative?
Well, I think you know 40 years ago that we were dealt a bad economic hand, so to speak. Industrial and, you know, manufacturing pulled out. Right. We hit a period where wages did not rise. I mean, we've experienced that for the last 50 years now. And, you know, the conventional wisdom says we just simply have a housing stock that exceeds the population. But what we've seen during that period of time is a government that really hasn't followed any principles when it comes to economic and community development. And the one thing that we advance at NESRI and the United Workers has been advancing is a set of principles to guide development. Principles of universality, of equity, of transparency, participation, and accountability. And what we've seen in development in Baltimore is essentially a real worship of the private market and private profit. And an attempt to subsidize that and hope it trickles down. And that's basically it's unusual given our democratic city that we're adopting such a Friedman-esque policy.
You mean Democrats and Democratic parties? What you
Democratic party, yes.
What
yes.
That means.
But the bottom line is it hasn't trickled down. It hasn't trickled down, and we've seen that for 40 years, and we're still doing the same policy, and it's not even a policy. Mel said earlier, we don't have, it keeps on changing.
So Mel and Jeff, then what should the policy be? And our other guests as well.
Well, there's...
How do you make, what is the policy we should be creating? How do we do it if that's not the way?
The policy. There's, right now, I mean, we all know that we have too many of the vacant properties. That in itself holds the entire city back. There's loss in revenue from taxes from those properties. There's more cost to police and fire rescue for those properties. There's decreased values for the surrounding properties that are blocks where they're 100% inhabited. There are many opportunities to reduce this number, create some stronger neighborhoods in themselves that actually have some open space near them. There are studies throughout the country that neighborhoods with more open space, more walkability, have higher property values, create more wealth for families, giving families in these neighborhoods of lower income an opportunity to increase their personal wealth because their property has increased in value.
Of course, we don't know if they do that, if these neighborhoods remain low income, or they just become the next wave of the 10,000 families of gentrification in Baltimore.
But it would still strengthen the families that are already there.
Agreed. Jeff?
Unfortunately, I'm not certain that there is a solution on the city level. I think there has to be a national, even international solution. But we do know that, as Peter mentioned, the economic development policies that we've been practicing for 50 years at least have failed. The median household income in Baltimore today is more than 10% less than it was in 1989. And it was less in 1989 than it was in 1979 or 69, and I've been gathering data on this topic. That means that economic development is failing. The poverty rate is more. The poverty rate in 1970 in Baltimore was about 17%, and today it's 25%. This means that the economic development strategies aren't working. So as you've been saying, Mark, we need a new set of policies. The first principle should be that the private sector, the market, shouldn't be the king. The market doesn't work in housing. It can't work for poor and middle-class people. It can't. The same thing's true in healthcare. The market wasn't designed, and its principles don't operate to make sure that everybody has affordable housing or affordable health care. So we need different ways of organizing those economic sectors.
So, Clara, what are your thoughts on how this should work? And then we're going to open the phones here.
The whole thing I'm saying, I'm sitting here listening to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, I went to a meeting that I wasn't even invited to. I didn't even know anything about it. That's
uh-huh.
how I got the response I got today.
Really?
Because I went to a meeting that I didn't know anything about, that I wasn't even invited to. I went to the meeting to find out exactly what was going on, because I know for a fact that the block they was going to wasn't as condemned as mine. So when I was at that meeting, I was like, well, why wasn't I notified? That's what I'm saying. When you're the only person on a block, it's like they forget you. Because if you're right there on Holbrook Street, I'm right there on Huffman. Holbrook and Huffman comes together. Yeah. It's no way in the world you did not see that my block was condemned, and even the back of the houses themselves, because majority of the houses are owned by the city. These houses are owned by the city. So the city isn't doing anything with their property. But then you're going to make your property, make my property less than what it is. Right now the houses in my block are bulking. So that means my house is now shifting because of the houses all coming to what? Towards the end.
Right.
So when you come and do that, as they say, come and give me that appraisal, I want you to take notice of the appraisal of how the houses next door to me are condemning my house. How they and they always say, well, you need to find a person that owns it and sue them. There is no one. Can I sue the city? Because part of them is part of this is their houses. So when you do my appraisal, I want you to think about how I just had my whole front repainted because to make my block a little bit more presentable. Because no one comes out. All you do is come out and put a little board up and walk away. You don't really board it up good enough because they can tear it right back down as soon as you board it up. I went to a meeting that I wasn't invited to. That's how I got on the list. Because I said, I'm not letting it slide this time. Because, like I said, I've been waiting for years for this. Now, if I wouldn't have went to that meeting, would I be in a predicament? Would I be in the situation I'm in right now? No, I would not. They would have just passed right by me again.
So, I mean, I think what you're saying is really emblematic of the larger issues that we face. And what we were talking about earlier when I challenged trying to pretend I was the city, that people are involved in the process. But for the most part, people are not involved in the process. I mean, you don't agree, Mel?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, we're going back to the same equation. If you're trying to organize in a neighborhood of high disinvestment, high vacancies, there's virtually no chance they're going to have a strong community association to be engaged. So who does the city go to? I mean, this might be one block, but there are neighborhoods where the entire community is highly disinvested in. It's not all of these 80. I'm not going to say that because some of them are fairly strong neighborhoods. But, You know, you're still talking about folks that have to spend their time on their families, their jobs, and being engaged in their community is third or fourth on their list. But there still has to be a way, an active engagement of knocking on doors and talking to folks and saying, I know you're busy, but we need you to be a part of this conversation. And someone has to do that.
So, go ahead. Now, I have to get the phones. A lot of people are calling in.
All right. Basically, that's why the United Workers are here, okay, because I'm one of the people that gets out there and does the door knocking and, you know, visit with people, talk about the issues that are, you know, in these neighborhoods. And I'm the one that goes out there. I petition all over the city.
Well, okay? if we're going to plug organizations, that's what CPHA does as well. Well, you know, we're out there organizing neighborhoods and making sure community associations are engaged.
We can use the help because the whole city needs to come together on these issues.
I agree.
And I for one, it's an issue of transparency. Okay? You cannot have these closed-door meetings making decisions that's going to affect these neighborhoods that you really don't care anything about. The only thing you care about is the equity.
Well, and that's a question. Somebody wrote in about the equity issue. Let me go to the phone, 410-319-8888. And Timothy, you're on the air. Hi, Timothy, you're on the air.
Okay.
Welcome.
Good morning.
Timothy?
Yes.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to the host and the guest on the show.
Good morning.
And I too, am a product of that Johnson Square area.
Go ahead.
One of the issues that I have is with we talk about vacant homes in the city, and majority of the property in the city that is vacant is city-owned. And whenever they say an owner hasn't done something to the property, they come in with eminent domain, take that property, and then just board it up, like Ms. Bailey said. Then they hold it for a while and let all the other houses around it become dilapidated, and then they tear it down, and they say they have a 10-year plan. But they wait for the developers to come in, and they get all the poor people out. What we have now, as far as the middle class in Baltimore, is a working poor.
Right. So, you're there, Timothy?
Yes, I'm here.
I didn't know if you had finished. I wasn't sure if you had finished your sentence.
And one of the other problems, other situation that I've known is the great granddaddy of the downtown partnership, right, was the Merchants and Tradesmen Association that was developed to take care of the port of Baltimore by Baltimore being a port city. When we had the Great Fire, all that area that was destroyed, at that time, John Hopkins owned like $1 million worth of property and was compensated for it. And they talked to all the merchants whose property was in the fire line that if they were willing to sacrifice their property to stop the fire, they would totally compensate them. And they've done that. And as we've seen over the years, all the money has been going down to the harbor and instead of equally distributed throughout the city. Baltimore City is becoming poorer and poorer because, like you said, people are leaving the city.
So,
Timmy, these homes where the homeless could be placed in and given a chance to purchase or work towards sweat equity or however.
So I want you to respond to our caller. And also one of our listeners wrote in, Jamal Hunt wrote in to say, the problem with the city is it's not only the government. It's also the owners of these properties. Many of them are asking too much money for the vacant properties. The properties in Baltimore are overpriced, and the amount of money to repair them is too much, money unless someone cares. Asking $30,000 for a home that is vacant and falling apart doesn't make sense. Paying $45,000 for a house with a hole in the back of the home and the roof is currently down with a massive hole doesn't make sense. And that's part of our problem is how we spend this money. So, responding to those two, what's the alternative? What should we be doing?
Well, I want to first point out the forces involved with a vacant house are many, and I'm not sure that there's one story that's going to fit every vacant house. But the bottom line here is that the the city does not necessarily own all these houses. I'm going to stick up for the city on this, okay? But it is city policy that has created and facilitated all these houses. And one of those policies is, again, a reflection of trusting the market to fix this, and that is the tax lien policy. We sell tax liens. We've done it forever in this city. It's an archaic policy. Other cities have gone away with that. Someone with a cell phone and an eBay account can basically buy the right, a public lien on a piece of property, get pennies for the dollar, force that property to foreclosure, and then what? And then sit on it. The bottom line is we have continued to use the values of the marketplace in trying to solve this problem. The Genesee County Community Land Bank did something completely different. They got rid of tax liens. Dan Kilday, who used to be the treasurer in Flint, and we're talking a county that has Flint, Michigan, in it. And they decided, no, if we're going to own the problem of vacants, we're going to own the property. And if the city actually took this property, we would have much more accountability, or at least we would demand that accountability, given the stuff that we're doing out there, because that is part and parcel of the problem here. The eminent domain, that occurs way down the line. We're talking a mixture of public and private here.
So any other comments before I go open the phones again? 410-319-8888. Gary, you're on the air. Gary, you there? You're on the air.
Okay, I'm on the air?
Yes, you are. You got to turn down. Right. Gotta turn your radio off, please.
I just did. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gary. Go ahead.
First of all, I'm very pleased to participate in this, and I was very thankful that one of your guests, Mark, talked about the big vision here. You know, this is not just a municipal thing. This is not just statewide and national. This is an international thing. One of my mantras is that half the world's population lives on less than $2 a day. And what we have to see here is a world where, you know, we have to begin to think about a world where money does not exist. You know, there are communities worldwide that are experimenting with this, and you have to experiment with it before you can come up with it, and I invoke the movie with Justin Timberlake in Time. Now, it's kind of out there, and I haven't seen all of it, but, you know, I just want people to think about the possibility of there being no such thing as money in the future. It may take us a very long time. It will take us a very long time.
Okay.
We must want for others what we want for ourselves. You know, this is like selfishness versus selflessness, and you know, one of the things that Bobby Seale used to, well, a lot of the Panthers back in the day, used to use the word avaricious. Avaricious means to be stingy and greedy at the same time. And what we have is we have so many avaricious people, particularly in the top tenth of the top 1% of the wealthy people on the face of this planet.
Okay.
And I'm not going to go on.
Yeah, because we have a lot of
off the air.
All right. Gary, thanks so much. And he called you out, actually, Jeff, but in comment also someone wrote that would tag on to this. Jane Taylor writes in, I'm tired of hearing the complaining about housing in the city. It's been the residents of these old houses who destroyed them. The neighborhoods could rebuild themselves instead of waiting for someone else to do it. I would think that the city would provide the paint and the lumber. Companies would provide old lumber instead of sitting on stoops or hanging out in the street corners, that people could rebuild these neighborhoods. There is much too much sitting around waiting for someone else to do the work. There's no initiative to take matters into their own hands and care about where they live one block at a time.
Gee, that's cruel. And it's not true either. There are a lot of folks throughout Baltimore, throughout every city, that have a lot of initiative and are trying. It's the resources and the way they're distributed that's the crime and that we should be focused on. When 93% of all the new wealth created in the United States during the Obama administration, 93% went to the top 1% of the population, the worst record in history, income inequality is so grossly dramatic now that people in neighborhoods don't have the means. Yes, they can get a hammer and nails and a board, but that's not going to do the job, as Mel indicated earlier, fixing up a vacant house can cost $100,000, and we can't rely on big developers and owners of lumber yards to solve the problem for us.
So let me just push this a tad further. I'd like all to jump in here before we go back to the phones. And Fred and Leo, we're going to try to get your calls. We're going to get back to our Facebook page where people said interesting things as well. If it can cost up to $100,000 to either to demolish or rehab a home, sometimes people say it's more to demolish a home, but whatever that number is, then I still don't hear from any of the advocates what the alternative is to the crisis we're facing. We know we have 40,000 vacants. What do we do with them? People without work or money living in the homes have no way to keep the homes up because there's no work or money. So what do we do? What is the alternative to what the city's doing, which is to sell them and tear them down and give them to developers to create a gentrification in this town? What is our alternative plan?
I don't think there's a citywide plan. Contrary to many conversations, I think we're talking about how neighborhoods become stronger. It doesn't take $100,000 to demolish a house, but it does take a pretty penny, somewhere in the order of $10,000 or $12,000, $15,000. So it's $12,000 or $13,000 to demolish, about $100,000 to redevelop it. But this is a conversation that needs to happen at an individual level in each neighborhood. I mean, once a neighborhood starts going past a tipping point of 50% vacancy, that's when you got problems. If you can keep a neighborhood that's got some fairly low vacancy numbers, and you can work with the residents, organize them, engage them, and say, hey, we're the only ones that are going to make a difference. We've got to make this block better to everybody else so someone's going to invest here. It's when that last vestige of residents stops planting those flowers or stops painting their shutters and they stop doing things and other neighbors stop doing things, that's when it's on its way down. And once it's on the downhill slide, a new strategy, a new plan needs to be created.
I would echo the participation here. I don't think it's a lack of good ideas. I can find money. I can. It's who decides what those ideas are. And Mel raised, I mean, that's fundamental. We need to decide where we're going to find the money. Public debt, bonds are a way that we spend money all the time when we don't have it. That's one thing the government can do that we cannot. We build stadiums when we don't have money. We add to the zoo when we don't have money. We just had a big movement down at Annapolis to get a big bond issue for the city schools. Creative, it was called. Next year, we're probably going to see some bond issue that renovates the Inner Harbor. We can borrow and we can shell out that money, but who makes that decision and for what? And so far, it's been for trickle-down economics that's not trickling down.
Look, you were about to say something, were you? Jeff?
Sure, always.
We have like 5 minutes left. I want to get to the guests as well.
So organizing neighborhoods, very important. Looking at public debt, extremely important. Who makes the rules? Democracy. We need to re-democratize the decision-making. It's not just in Baltimore. This happens all over the country. And we can't do it one city at a time, unfortunately, although we need to be organizing in Baltimore. But if we have reasonable taxes on developers and don't subsidize their profits, which is what we've been doing for 50 years. If we didn't do that, then it's true. They'll move somewhere else where they can get subsidized. So we can't do this one city at a time. We have to do it nationally and, as I mentioned earlier, probably internationally.
So we literally had like three minutes left. Clara, could you, living in the midst of it, your thoughts on what you heard today?
I mean, I heard a lot today, but I'm still saying the same thing. All of this sounds fine and dandy, but like I was saying, I've been fighting this battle for over 20 years. And in 20 years' time, everything that you said about the Inner Harbor, you know, where the money goes, you can find the money. What happened to that when it came to the 1100 block of Huffman Street? What happened to all of that? What happened to them taking care of that property, the city, or whoever owns it? What happened to what happened to the neighborhood? I live right there by Greenmount Cemetery, which is supposed to be historical boundaries. Well, what happened? What happened to the historic? What happened to you just even coming by? I don't even have a street sweeper. What happened to the city coming back and looking? I seen the mayor go to Preston Street when they had the new housing and cut the ribbon. But when is she going to stop on Huffman Street and say, okay, you can stop by here where it's homicide, where people are getting killed. You got everybody around here then. But what happened to the caring of the neighborhoods that people still live in?
Now, Claire Bailey, you've had the last word, at least for today. We're going to come back to this. Clearly, this is a subject that touches the nerve of our community. We've got to keep pushing it, and we will. And Bobby Marr from Holmes, one of my producers, is nodding his head, hearing what I'm saying, and we will push it because we have to. This is an issue that I think that needs to have clarification. It would be good to have our mayors and others visit. One of the ways they do that is for the communities to organize.
That's right.
And to on the street and in the voting booth to make their voice heard for a change in what our policies should be. You got to fight back to make it work. Clara Bailey, thank you so much. Randy Ford, United Workers, good to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeff Singer, founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless. Peter Sabonis, now Human Right to Work with Dignity Program co-director for the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. And Mel Freeman, executive director of Citizens Planning and Housing Association. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you, Mark.
And all our listeners here for writing in and calling in with their ideas and questions and thoughts. I'll jump on to Facebook later and respond to all of you who have written with my thoughts and what we just heard and what you've been writing. Thank you all so much. We're going to take a very brief break and come back.